Welcome to the Verity Podcast for Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, where we separate the spin from the facts. I'm Scott Wallace.
And I'm Eric Steiner. Here's a look at today's top stories. Israel says it has no choice but to retaliate against Iran.
Police identify the Sydney Mall stabbing attacker.
As the city experiences another stabbing at a church.
Narendra Modi's party releases its Indian election manifesto.
A Ukrainian commander says the Eastern Front has deteriorated significantly.
Jury selection begins in Trump's hush money trial.
U.S. news organizations urge Biden and Trump to debate.
Documents show Biden used donor funds for legal fees.
A former Australian government staffer is found liable for rape.
And a commission recommends that Germany legalize abortions in the first 12 weeks.
The Israeli defense minister says no choice but to retaliate against Iran. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Axios, Reuters, The Times of Israel, The Guardian, and Barron's. Axios reported that Israeli defense minister Yoav Gallant told U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin on Sunday that Israel had no choice but to respond to Iran's attack on Israel over the weekend, which saw Iran launch around 350 drones and missiles at Israel in response to Israel's bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Austin reportedly said that Israel must do everything it can to avoid escalation. U.S. President Joe Biden told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Saturday that the U.S. will not support any Israeli counterattack against Iran, according to a U.S. official. Regional officials said that Iran had informed the U.S. about its planned attack on Israel and given days of notice before it was launched. However, the U.S. denied these claims, saying that Tehran did not warn Washington and Iran's goal was to inflict substantial damage. Israeli outlet Channel 12, without citing any specific sources, reported that during a war cabinet meeting held on Monday to discuss Israel's response to the Iranian attack, the cabinet decided to hit back clearly and forcefully against Iran, but avoid a regional war or shattering the coalition that assisted in Israel's defense. As tensions continue, it was reported on Monday that four Israeli soldiers were injured by a bomb inside Lebanon, making it the first admitted entry into Lebanese territory by Israeli forces. Israel's military confirmed the casualties after Lebanon's Hezbollah, which is backed by Iran, claimed it ambushed a group of Israeli soldiers after they crossed the border. Separately, Lebanese officials suggested on Monday that Israel's Mossad intelligence agency may have assassinated Mohammed Sarour, a U.S.-sanctioned Lebanese citizen accused of facilitating Iranian financial support for Hamas. Sarour was found dead in the Lebanese mountain town of Beit Miri last week.
On this podcast, we separate the spin from the facts. Eric laid out the grim facts. And now for some narratives, starting with a pro-establishment spin from CNN. The U.S. is doing everything it can to ensure that Israel deter military threats while also preventing regional escalation. Israel must be able to defend itself from terrorist attacks, whether from Gaza or elsewhere. And the U.S. will always defend Israel's right to security. Nonetheless, it's not in the U.S.'s or Israel's best interest to see the conflict escalate. Thankfully, Israel, with the assistance of the U.S. and its regional allies, managed to effectively counter Iran's attack, and any further Israeli military actions are completely unnecessary.
And the pro-Israel narrative comes from Jerusalem Post. Though this has been a tragic war, Israel must eliminate Hamas and prevent Iran from achieving any symbolic or strategic victories in the wake of October 7th. Though Israel did not and does not want this war, Iranian meddling has pushed the region to the brink. It has been made clear that Israel will not allow Iran's terror armies to hold positions on its borders. And if Israel does not thoroughly respond to this escalation, Iran will only be more emboldened to the attack.
The pro-Palestine narrative comes from The Intercept. Once again, the media have taken the bait and looked over the fact that Israel is purposefully trying to drag the U.S. into a war with Iran to distract from its daily massacres in Gaza. If President Biden had not chosen to blindly follow Netanyahu into the abyss, the situation almost certainly could have been avoided. Israel has turned into a pariah state in the global community, and if the U.S. wants to prevent the region from falling into chaos, it must end Israel's war on Gaza.
And Al-Mayadeen's pro-Iran narrative says that Iran continues to demonstrate its capabilities and restraint, as the attack over the weekend will hopefully serve as a good wake-up call to Israel to end this series of escalations. Iran and its allies have been clear from day one that they do not want to see this war spiral into a regional conflict. Rather, Iran only seeks to end Israel's crimes in Gaza, to which it has been forced to respond. Israel made a mistake in believing that Iran would not respond to its provocations, and Tehran's leadership will continue to calculate its moves appropriately.
And from time to time, we have statistics-based nerd narratives brought to us by the Metaculous Prediction Community. They say there's a 20% chance that a state-based conflict between Israel and Iran will cause at least 1,000 deaths before 2025. Eric, I was kind of glued to the TV when this news broke over the weekend. Personally, I do think we're kind of reaching an inflection point here. One thing I noticed is that in the footage, cars were just driving around normally as the explosions were going off in the air. I mean, that shows some real confidence in that missile security system.
Isn't it like that in your town every day anyway?
Right.
Yeah,
yep.
You just have a tolerance for it, don't you?
Yeah,
I get it.
I guess. I mean, people were just driving around. But I saw a Buick LeSabre just driving down the street, and I was like, wow, that guy really needs to get to work.
What year was it?
I think it looked like late 80s, early 90s.
That was before they put the 4.8 liter in it, wasn't it?
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, that explains it.
What color was it?
It was like tan. Police identify the Sydney mall stabbing attacker. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the New South Wales Police, Reuters, News 9 Australia, BBC News, The Associated Press, and ABC News of Australia. New South Wales Police have identified a 40-year-old man who fatally stabbed 6 people and critically injured at least 12 others at Sydney's Westfield Bondi Junction Mall on Saturday before he was shot and killed by a senior police officer. According to law enforcement, the assailant, Joel Couchy, belonged to the northeastern Australian state of Queensland, had been recently sleeping in his car, and was known to the Queensland police. However, he was never arrested or charged with any crimes. New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb ruled out terrorism or ideological motivation, adding that a probe has been launched to determine why Couchy singled out women. Joel's father, Andrew Couchy, described his son as a very sick boy, suffering from schizophrenia, claiming he may have targeted women because he, quote, wanted a girlfriend, alleging he had no social skills and that he was frustrated out of his brain. Joel's victims included Dawn Singleton, 25, Jade Young, 47, Ashley Good, 38, Pikria Darchia, 55, and Yishuan Cheng, 25, all women. The only man killed was Faraz Tahir, 30, a Pakistani refugee who worked at the mall as a security guard. Out of the 12 victims who survived their injuries, including Good's 9-month-old baby, 8 remained in hospital on Monday.
Scott, thanks for those facts. The first spin is Narrative A, coming from Voice of America. Saturday's tragedy could have been avoided if only the attacker's mental health was taken seriously, both by his family and law enforcement. Despite having a chronic brain disorder, Joel had access to combat knives. He was known to the Queensland police, yet his activities weren't monitored. Innocent people have paid with their lives for a man driven by mental illness.
Narrative B comes from CNN. Saturday's stabbing wouldn't have taken place if the mall security guard had been armed. Blaming a mentally ill person squarely for a massacre is a distraction from government negligence and responsibility. Joel needed help, which he was denied. Now that he is deceased, he has been blamed for law enforcement's failure to prevent a horrific tragedy.
Narrative C comes from BBC News. This horrific act of violence, Australia's deadliest in at least 8 years, has stunned and horrified a country where mass killings are rare. Joel has been punished for indiscriminately targeting innocent shoppers. It's paramount to thank the police and emergency services for their bravery in the face of this shocking incident and support the families of victims and eyewitnesses in these grim times.
The University of Sydney brings us Narrative D. There's no doubt that mass casualty events are rare in Australia. However, Saturday's attack should kick off another national debate about gun control. As Australians who already own guns have bought more, and there's an increase in new gun owners since Canberra implemented one of the world's toughest gun laws more than 2 decades ago, Joel's horrific crimes serve as a warning against complacency.
And the horror continues in Australia as a bishop and 3 others have been injured in a Sydney church stabbing. Here are the facts as agreed upon by The Guardian, ABC Australia, The Telegraph, NBC, BBC News, and PBS NewsHour. 4 people, including a Syrian Orthodox Bishop Mar Mari Emmanuel, were injured in a caught-on-camera stabbing during a mass in Sydney's western suburb of Wakeley on Monday evening. All of them suffered non-life-threatening injuries and were treated by paramedics before being taken to hospital, with Bishop Emmanuel said to be in a critical but stable condition. A live stream of the Mass showed graphic footage of a person dressed in black launching a knife attack on the bishop before worshipers rushed to stop him. A 15-year-old boy has been arrested for the stabbing. New South Wales police arrived at the scene following a call from the Christ the Good Shepherd Church at 7:10 p.m. local time, remaining there for at least 3 hours and urging the public to avoid the area. Clashes erupted in the area as hundreds gathered to reportedly demand the police to take the culprit outside, injuring two police officers and damaging vehicles after hurling bricks, bottles, and stones. This incident comes after another violent stabbing left 6 people dead and injured more than a dozen others in a Sydney shopping mall on Saturday. The two attacks are not believed to be linked.
Oh, thanks for those tragic facts, Eric. We have 3 narratives. Let's start with narrative A from the Daily Mail. This is a deeply tragic event that must be deeply investigated. Although the motive of the attacker is unclear, Emmanuel was a polarizing figure and this could have been a personal attack. There are many potential angles that must be probed to the fullest.
Narrative B comes from Right Angle News Network. Too little is being covered by mainstream news outlets to investigate if this was an attack on the Christian faith. Although still in the early stages, it's vital to explore if hate crimes against Emmanuel's faith were a motivating factor in this heinous attack.
And finally, a nerd narrative from Metaculus. There's a 46% chance that no religion responses will represent at least 50% of the Australian population in the 2026 census. News from India as Modi's party releases an election manifesto. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the Times of India, Businessline, NDTV, Al Jazeera, India Today, and the Indian Express. Ahead of the national election, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi released his party's poll platform on Sunday, promising to make the country the 3rd largest economic power. Titled Modi's Guarantee 2024, the manifesto focuses on the welfare and development of all, exponential economic growth, poverty eradication, and free and quality healthcare. Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party claims the manifesto empowers women, youth, poor, and farmers, the 4 pillars of his vision of a developed India. The Prime Minister's poll promises include extending the government's free ration scheme by 5 years and continuing the annual 6,000 rupee or 72 American dollars aid to each eligible farmer. In addition, Modi has promised to bid for the 2036 Olympic Games and push for nationwide electoral reforms, including implementing his proposed One Nation, One Election policy. The Indian national election begins on April 19th and will be held across 7 stages through June 1st. The results will be declared on June 4th.
Scott, thanks for the facts. The right narrative is our first spin, coming from the Hindu Times. Modi's party manifesto promises to build on India's progress over the past decade, especially in digital advancements and infrastructure. It pledges support for scientific research and promoting local languages. The manifesto isn't merely about winning the next round of national elections. It's more about deciding on the issue of a robustly developed India by 2047.
And a left narrative spin from Reuters. BJP's manifesto fails to address major economic issues like labor and land laws. It prioritizes continuity over significant change. It has no word on doubling farmers' income like it grandiosely did in 2019 and failed to keep. Voters will see through this smokescreen of rhetorical devices like Ramayana festivals and half-baked welfare measures.
And the nerds from Metaculus say there's a 50% chance that India will become a World Bank high-income country by November of 2049. The Ukrainian commander says the Eastern Front has deteriorated significantly. The facts are agreed upon by DW, the Kyiv Independent, the Institute for the Study of War, and Ukrainska Pravda. After weeks of Russian gains in the eastern Donetsk region, Oleksandr Sirsky, the commander-in-chief of Ukraine's armed forces, conceded that the frontline situation in the country's east has deteriorated significantly in comments over the weekend. Sirsky said that fighting had intensified after Russia's presidential election last month, and that Russia has actively been attacking Ukrainian positions in the Liman, Bakhmut, and Pokrovsk sectors of Donetsk in recent days. He further stated that the situation around Chazif Yar, 12 miles west of Bakhmut, was particularly difficult and tense. Later in the weekend, without specifying how he got the information, Sirsky alleged that Russia planned to take control of Chazif Yar by May 9th, the date when Russia marks the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. However, Sirsky added, quote, the enemy's plans are being hampered by the heroic defense of our brigades. According to the latest analysis from the Institute for the Study of War, or ISW, a military-affiliated think tank that tracks battlefield progress in the war, Russian forces continue to advance on multiple axes towards Chasiv Yar on Sunday. Meanwhile, according to a report in Ukrainian media on Sunday, an ultra-nationalist Ukrainian volunteer brigade known as Right Sector was being put under investigation, and its forces were transferred from the defense of Chasiv Yar to other units after battlefield losses in the region. Sources who spoke to Ukrainska Pravda said that an audit of Right Sector troops revealed that they discriminated against what they described as, quote, pixels, the freshly conscripted troops that stood out as a result of their pixelated uniforms. They were the first to be sent to battle and often lost ground, the sources said.
Thanks, Eric, for that conflict update. PBS NewsHour brings us the pro-establishment narrative. Delays in Western military aid to Ukraine will seriously hamper the country's ability to hold back Russia's advances. 3 years into the war, Russia is deploying more advanced weaponry and is stepping up its firepower. It's more vital than ever that the U.S. approves a new batch of military aid.
And TASS has the pro-Russian narrative. Russian troops continue to advance in the Donetsk region, namely in the direction of Chasiv Yar. As was conceded in the Ukraine media, that's because experienced fighters know what fate awaits them and are sending the new troops out to die.
Okay, and a nerd narrative from Metaculus. There is a 4% chance there will be a bilateral ceasefire or peace agreement in the Russo-Ukraine conflict in 2024. Jury selection begins in the Trump hush money trial. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, NBC, the New York Post, and Reuters. Jury selection began Monday for former U.S. President Donald Trump's criminal trial on 34 felony charges of allegedly falsifying business records to hide hush money payments to Karen McDougal, a.k.a. Stormy Daniels. The charges include falsifying records to hide a $130,000 reimbursement Trump gave to his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, which the attorney made to Daniels in October 2016 to keep her quiet about an alleged 2006 sexual encounter she had with Trump. Judge Juan Merchan will dismiss any prospective jurors who say they can't be impartial or otherwise serve. The remaining jurors will answer a 42-question survey with lawyers from the prosecution and defense allowed to dismiss a select number they deem ineligible. Jury questions range from whether or not they've worked for a pro- or anti-Trump organization to what media they consume. While Merchan said he won't ask about party affiliations, the defense claims Trump can't get a fair trial in the city with heavy Democratic Party representation. The prosecution has asked Merchan on Monday to fine Trump $1,000 for each of three social media posts he wrote this month about Cohen and Daniels. Trump's legal team has until Friday to respond, and Merchan set an April 23rd hearing date on the matter. Trump, who is required to attend the entirety of what could be an eight-week-long trial, faces 4 years in prison if convicted. This is the first time in history that a former president has gone to trial facing criminal charges.
Thanks, Scott. The first spin for this story is an anti-Trump narrative coming from Washington Post. This case is historic not only because it's the first federal prosecution of a former president, but because it relates to Trump's first attempt to steal an election. By illegally falsifying business documents to keep this hush money hidden, Trump blatantly violated the law in 2016 to ensure American voters were unaware of his wrongdoings. Trump is yet again attempting to skirt the law to obtain power he could otherwise never achieve.
The pro-Trump narrative from Revolver News. Alvin Bragg's case against Trump may be the clearest example of the Biden regime's grasping at straws legal strategy to damage their 2024 opponent. After failing to find any real crimes, Bragg reimagined the law to turn what had always been a misdemeanor into a felony. These alleged hidden hush money payments have been publicly denied by Stormy Daniels herself in 2006, 2011, 2016, 17, and 18. The government has weaponized the judicial system against the former president.
The nerds from Metaculus say there's a 50% chance that Donald Trump will be convicted of a felony before the 2024 presidential election. Trump's still in the news as U.S. news organizations call for Biden and Trump to commit to debates. Here are the facts as agreed upon by C-SPAN, Reuters, BBC News, the Commission on Presidential Debates, Associated Press, and Real Clear Polling. A dozen news outlets have released a joint statement calling for candidates who expect to meet the eligibility criteria for November's U.S. presidential election to publicly state their intention to commit to debates scheduled for this fall. The letter is signed by ABC News, CBS News, NBC Universal News Group, Fox, CNN, C-SPAN, PBS NewsHour, News Nation, Univision, NPR, AP News, and USA Today. The letter claims the ramifications of 2024's election to be exceptionally high, while stating that there was no substitute for the rich tradition of the debate format, which has been televised since 1976. In November 2023, the Commission on Presidential Debates announced its intent to hold four events in 2024, three presidential debates in Texas, September 16th, Virginia, October 1st, and Utah, October 9th, as well as a vice presidential debate in Pennsylvania, September 25th. U.S. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, once again the presumptive nominee for their respective parties, debated twice in 2020 after a third was canceled after Trump tested positive for COVID. Latest data from Real Clear Politics polling averages shows, as of April 13th, Trump's 45.6% is ahead of Biden's 45.4% by a margin of 0.2 percentage points, having led the current president in this poll since late October of 2023.
Thanks for that update. We got a pro-Trump narrative, Eric, here from the Epoch Times. Despite repeated assurances from the Trump campaign that the former president is more than willing to debate Biden, it's clear that the memories of the 2020 election still haunt the Biden administration. Unwilling to have the president embarrassed on national television once again, Democrats continue to shield an aging and politically ineffective Biden from the public.
CNN has the Democratic narrative. It's up to Biden to decide whether he should allow Trump the opportunity to spread further lies on national television. While debate between presidential candidates should be encouraged, Trump's brazen willingness to spread misinformation for personal gain is of no benefit to American democracy.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 57% chance that a debate be held between Joe Biden and Donald Trump before the 2024 U.S. presidential election. More news from the campaign trail as Biden used donor funds to pay his legal bills. Here are the facts as agreed upon by The Washington Post, Axios, The Telegraph, and ABC News. According to an Axios report, Federal Election Commission documents show that President Joe Biden has used donor funds to pay legal bills. This comes as Biden has levied criticism at former President Donald Trump for engaging in the same practice. Records indicate that Biden spent $2 million in donations to cover his legal fees. Over $1 million reportedly went to Bob Bauer, Biden's personal lawyer, who oversaw the probe into Biden's handling of classified documents. Law firm Hemingway & Barnes reportedly received over $900,000. This comes as the Biden campaign made remarks last weekend that every single time you give to the campaign, we're going straight to talk to voters. We are not spending any money on legal bills or hawking gold sneakers. The comments were a reference to the Trump campaign. The Republican National Committee responded with allegations of hypocrisy by the Biden campaign in response to the report. Trump has reportedly spent around $55.6 million on legal expenditures this year, reportedly reallocating donor funds from two of his political action committees.
Thanks, Scott. Fox News has the first spin. It's a Republican narrative. The Democrats' whole campaign against President Trump is constructed around hyperbole and hypocrisy. While condemning Trump for needing to defend himself against Biden's witch hunts, the DNC has repeatedly said they don't use PAC money for Biden's legal bills. Sadly and unsurprisingly, it turns out that the DNC has spent millions of dollars doing just that.
And The Guardian brings us the Democratic narrative. There's no comparison between the two campaigns. The Republican National Committee is now acting as the fundraising arm for Donald Trump's criminal defense. Biden does not use PAC money as essentially his personal checking account like Trump does. Unlike Trump, the DNC does not spend any of its grassroots supporters' money on legal fees. That is a huge difference.
And Campaign Legal Center has the cynical narrative. Voters of all political persuasions are the losers here. Donor funds funneled through PACs and super PACs have created an oligarchical, symbiotic relationship between both political parties and wealthy interests. All voters, both Republicans and Democrats, should be deeply concerned that special interest funding is incompatible with American democracy.
And we have a nerd narrative from Metaculus. There's a 40% chance that Donald J. Trump will be convicted of at least one count in his federal court cases before the end of 2024.
More news from Australia as a government staffer has been found liable for rape. And here are the facts as agreed upon by Al Jazeera, Barron's, The Guardian, NBC, Sky News, and BBC News. In a civil case on the balance of probabilities, rather than the criminal requirement of beyond a reasonable doubt, Australian Judge Michael Lee ruled that former government staffer Bruce Learman raped colleague Brittany Higgins in a minister's office in 2019. Learman was tried in criminal court, but his case was thrown out after a courtroom sheriff found one of the jurors with an academic paper on sexual assault, a violation of trial rules, and prosecutors declined to retry the case over concerns for Higgins' mental health. Learman then filed a lawsuit against Network 10 and journalist Lisa Wilkinson, claiming they defamed him in an interview with Higgins, during which she accused him of rape. Judge Lee tossed out the defamation suit on Monday, ruling that, quote, Mr. Learman raped Ms. Higgins. However, the judge added, quote, I hasten to stress this is a finding on the balance of probabilities. Lee further stated that Learman, who had been out drinking that night with colleagues, committed the sexual assault. Lee also criticized Network 10, particularly surrounding reports that the then-ruling Liberal Party had sought to cover up the rape allegations. He called the allegation, quote, objectively short on facts, but long on speculation.
Well, thanks, Eric. We have a Narrative A from 9 News Australia. Learman was lucky to narrowly escape his criminal proceedings, but he was so hell-bent on publicizing his lies that he found himself back in the spotlight, and this time his true nature was revealed. Judge Lee rightfully exposed Learman not only as a man attempting to hide his infidelity, but one with no care for the well-being and dignity of women.
And the Australian has Narrative B. While the court has made its official decision on Learman, this case should not bring joy to either side. The media was absolutely reckless in its reporting, particularly regarding the false accusations of a government cover-up. Sexual assault allegations must be litigated in government courts, not the court of public opinion, and 10 News violated that code of ethics.
Our final story, a commission rules Germany should legalize abortion up to 12 weeks. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by BBC News, CNN, Reuters, and The Washington Post. A government-appointed commission recommended on Monday that Germany lift all abortion restrictions within the first 12 weeks of pregnancy, but maintain its ban on abortion after fetal viability at 22 weeks. Abortion is generally illegal in Germany, although exceptions are made in cases of rape or life-threatening situations, or within the first 12 weeks after undergoing an official medical consultation. The law, however, is rarely enforced, causing a legal gray area in the country, which can make it difficult for women to undergo the procedure within the first 12 weeks of pregnancy due to stigmatization and financial and logistical barriers. The recommendation was made by the Commission on Reproductive Self-Determination and Reproductive Medicine, an all-female panel set up last year by the coalition government of the center-left Social Democratic Party, the Greens, and the Free Democrats. The 628-page report published on Monday stressed that Germany's existing abortion laws need modernizing to align with international standards, with Leanne Warner, a lawyer who leads the commission, saying keeping early-stage abortions illegal was no longer tenable. The decision whether to accept the commission's advice or not will now be determined by Chancellor Olaf Scholz's center-left coalition.
Thanks, Scott. The first spin is Narrative A coming from The Guardian. This recommendation will align Germany's abortion laws with international standards and its European peers. Although abortion is rarely prosecuted in the country, the current rules could easily allow future governments to issue punishments for those who seek out the procedure. Changing the law will protect women's human rights now and in the future.
Narrative B from CNN. The current law allows enough protection for women seeking abortions in Germany. It would be unnecessary for the law to be changed. The commission likely has a strong liberal bias when they made this recommendation, and many ethical and legal considerations must be examined with this issue.
Thanks for listening to the Verity Podcast for Tuesday, April 16th, 2024.
Each day we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers to figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team then extracts both the key facts that all articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
Find out more at Verity.news and download the Verity app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Scott Wallace, I'm Eric Steiner, inviting you to join us next time on the Verity Podcast.